You're listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. In this podcast series, we bring international affairs expertise from Stanford's campus straight to you. With continued revelations about Russian hacking during the U.S. elections, the relationship between our two countries is worsening by the day. In December 2016, FSI convened a panel of experts, including former Ambassador Michael McFaul and former Defense Secretary William Perry, to discuss the past and future of U.S.-Russia relations.
Good afternoon, everyone. I want to invite you all to get seated and get comfortable for a very interesting afternoon. I want to welcome you all. My name is Amy Ziegert. I'm a senior fellow and the co-director of the Center for International Security and Cooperation here in the Freeman Spogli Institute, and I'm also a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. Boy, are we lucky to have this panel this afternoon. It is no more timely moment to be looking at the past, present, and future of U.S.-Russian relations and nuclear security than today. Let me add, for those of you who may not have seen the news, that Tom Schelling, one of the great strategic thinkers in nuclear security, passed away today. So it's particularly fitting that we reflect in part on the ideas and the contributions of the distinguished panelists that we have here, and Tom Schelling, whose work was so central to deterrence theory during the Cold War. Now, each of our panelists, I have to add on a lighter note since it is the holiday season, has written one, if not more, critically acclaimed books with very uplifting titles like Doomed to Cooperate, My Journey at the Nuclear Brink, Stalin and the Bomb, right, and The Dead Hand. Mike McFaul has written a book that he's recently finished that's due out soon, so I'm hoping there's a more uplifting title than
all
that.
My titles are way more uplifting than these other people. Go to Amazon and buy them.
So if you're looking for an uplifting holiday package for your relatives, you need to look no further than the books written by authors on our panel. It gives me great pleasure to start by introducing someone who needs no introduction, our own Bill Perry, the 19th Secretary of Defense under President Bill Clinton, a man, for those of you who know him and those of you who don't, of supreme wisdom, honor, and service to our nation throughout his life. He was very much at the center of U.S.-Russia policy in the aftermath of the Cold War, and during his time in office, he was instrumental in dramatically reducing nuclear risks in our world. His book, published last year, called My Journey at the Nuclear Brink, discusses his lifelong association and his thinking about nuclear weapons, and if I'm going to put it in an unsolicited plug for what Bill is doing now, it's part of his current mission to educate the younger generation about the enduring dangers of nuclear risks and what they can do to reduce those risks. So he's as well versed in teenage slang as he is in nuclear engineering. Not many people can say that. His official title is he is the Michael and Barbara Babarian Professor Emeritus here at Stanford and a senior fellow both at the Freeman Spogli Institute, where he's at CSAC, and also at the Hoover Institution. To his left, we have Mike McFaul, who's the director and senior fellow here at FSI. He's the Peter and Helen Bing Senior Fellow at Hoover and Professor of Political Science at Stanford. As many of you know, Mike spent 5 years in the Obama administration, first as Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russian and Eurasian Affairs at the National Security Council. And then he was the U.S. Ambassador to the Russian Federation from 2012 to 2014. During his time in Moscow, he served as one of the most high-profile ambassadors during one of the most challenging junctures in U.S.-Russian relations, including resurgent Russian nationalism and an American in Russia named Edward Snowden. He has spent his academic career writing much more uplifting book titles on Russia and democratization. His many books include Advancing Democracy Abroad and Russia's Unfinished Revolution, Political Change from Gorbachev to Putin. He's been called by many the leading scholar of his generation, and you can see him now quite frequently on NBC and read his writings in the Washington Post. Next to him, we have David Holloway. He's the Raymond Spruance Professor of International History, Professor of Political Science, and a senior fellow here at FSI. And throughout his esteemed career, David has written prolifically on the history of nuclear weapons, particularly in the Soviet Union, and has worked on technical and policy issues related to U.S.-Russian national security policy at the highest levels. His renowned book, Stalin and the Bomb, The Soviet Union and Atomic Energy, was chosen by the New York Times Book Review as one of the 11 best books of 1994 when it came out, and has won numerous honors, including from the American Association for the Advancement of Slavic Studies. Next to him, we have, of course, the man who was instigating this entire event, Sig Hecker. Sig Hecker has a book. This is only half of the book to give you some idea of how comprehensive this book is. I couldn't take the other half because I would have pulled out my back. It's called Doomed to Cooperate, and it is quite a remarkable achievement. And the idea of this panel today emanated from the publication of Sig's book earlier in the year. It tells the story of the instrumental and courageous work of Sig and his colleagues, both in the United States and in the former Soviet Union, now Russia, to keep the lines of communication open following the collapse of the Soviet Union. It has been called a story of heroes, scientists willing to risk quite a bit to work together to save the world from catastrophic risks. I just have to ask for your indulgence to read one comment from Sam Nunn, who wrote this about the book, and I would encourage you to read both volumes of the book. Here's what Senator Nunn said. We can only guess how many catastrophes were avoided by the remarkable cooperation between dedicated scientists, military, and other government officials in the United States and Russia to prevent nuclear weapons and materials from falling into dangerous hands in the years following the Cold War. We do know that the global risks were significantly reduced by this cooperation from former bitter enemies. This is a task that never ends. And Sig Hecker, who has done more than any other American to strengthen U.S. and Russian scientific cooperation, tells us how critical it is for this work to be revived today. Sig has an official title here, which is a professor of research in the Department of Management, Science, and Engineering and senior fellow at FSI. But of course, as many of you know, for several years, from 1986 to 1997, Sig served as the fifth director of Los Alamos National Laboratory. And finally, last but not least, we're delighted that David Hoffman was able to join us from the East Coast to moderate this panel. David is contributing editor at the Washington Post, and the Post's Moscow bureau chief from 1995 to 2001. He has spent a career writing about U.S. politics and U.S.-Russian relations. His 2009 book, The Dead Hand, won the Pulitzer Prize in 2010 for general nonfiction, and it provides a terrifying account of the enormous and covert effort of the Soviet Union to build biological, chemical, and nuclear weapons to counter American power near the end of the Cold War. If Sig Hecker's book, Doomed to Cooperate, is the in-depth personal account of this period, David Hoffman's The Dead Hand tells the story of the period through the eyes of political leaders in both the U.S. and Russia, or the Soviet Union at the time. With that, let me turn it over to David Hoffman, who will lead our panel discussion. Thank you very much.
Amy, thank you very much. Thank all of you for coming here today. It's a very timely moment, and it's actually quite humbling for me to be up here as a journalist and an author and a student of Russia all these years. I've been asked to moderate a panel with the people who taught me. So you're going to get
none
the
of
best.
Us have a Pulitzer, David.
Yeah.
Well, okay.
So I'm very humbled by this. 21 years ago, I arrived in Moscow as the correspondent for the Washington Post. I was full of optimism. I realized that Russia was full of problems, but I believed it was a time of promise. One of my very first stories for the Post was about a high school teacher, Igor Dolutsky, who wrote the first honest textbook about Soviet history, one that told the truth about the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, and one that he told me would not contain gaps and lies like so many textbooks before. I told my readers in 1995 that Igor Dolutsky had realized his dream in the new Russia. The textbook was published and distributed and used in high school classrooms. And a few months after that, I got another front page story when I spent the day with a young Democratic candidate for the State Duma, the lower house of parliament for the December 1995 elections. His name was Yevgeny Bushmin. He was 37 years old at the time. He had been a partner with Boris Nemtsov in some of the reforms establishing the first stock market and in Nizhny Novgorod. And I spent the day roaming over this town that was really one of the old relics of the Soviet military-industrial establishment as he tried to talk to people about the meaning of democracy and the changes that they all saw coming. And I wrote in the Post that day that the politicking underscored the woes, troubles, and confusions of Russian voters in this season of discontent, but also highlighted the fascinating, wobbly, striving character of Russia's young democracy. At that time, for that election, there were 42 parties trying to get on the ballot for the Russian Duma. And then later in my tour in Moscow, I met Viktor Vysinsky, who had been a head of department at the Central Aeronautics Unit Institute in Moscow, where he tested Soviet cruise missiles in giant wind tunnels. His real expertise was putting those missiles in a wind tunnel and seeing how they would perform. But of course, when the Soviet Union collapsed, the need for his services sort of fell apart. The Institute was still there. He still had an office. Nobody had been paid for many, many months. And Viktor was experimenting in the new Russia by learning how to convert himself into something useful for Russian society. He had spent some time studying the wakes that airplanes, civilian airplanes, cause when they take off from airports, and it also worked on an amazing invention to put timber in those big wind tunnels and dry it twice as fast. I thought it was a noble and interesting endeavor, and I wrote about this as part of an institution called the International Science and Technology Committee that was, ISTC was an effort to get a lot of these scientists who had worked on weapons programs in Soviet times to change their way of thinking and contribute on a civilian basis. So fast forward to today. Igor Dolutsky's textbook made it into classrooms and then was banned in 2003. Yevgeny Bushmin didn't get elected that day to the Duma, but he continued to rise in Russian government. He eventually made it into the upper chamber, the Federation Council. I was stunned 2 years ago to find Yevgeny Bushmin's name on the list of Russian officials sanctioned by the United States because he had voted for Putin's intervention in Ukraine. And the ISTC that had helped Viktor with his wind tunnel conversion has been kicked out of Russia. It still exists in a few other places, but the whole effort to help these scientists has ended. And at the same time, the whole arms control and threat reduction effort of these years is falling apart. So this is where we are today. All of us here have understood the important distinction between Russian state and society, one that runs through its history. I still have some hopes for Russian society. But the Russian state has turned adversarial. And that is where we are. And questions we have to ask, and I hope that all of us will discuss today, is can we engage if Russia's turned adversarial, and how? Should we? Where have we been and where are we going with Russia? And I think each of the panelists will address the question, what do they see as both their greatest experiences in this period I'm talking about and the greatest challenges and disappointments? And I hope by the end of this discussion we can also address what is the role of the United States in the West, and particularly what parts of this incredible experience are reusable? Do we have a reusable history here? Can we apply it to the future of relations with Russia and other crises that we confront? So with that, we'll start with Bill Perry.
Thank you. Thank you, David. So I start off with the question, what is the greatest challenge of the post-Soviet era? And to answer that question, I went back to a book that Ash Carter and I had written almost 20 years ago now, in which it says, the greatest challenge of the post-Soviet era is avoiding what we call Weimar Russia, Weimar Russia, in which a former enemy, isolated by the rest of the world, could fall prey to its worst tendencies. Where do we get the word Weimar Russia? We got it from a Stanford historian. We borrowed it from a Stanford historian, Gordon Craig, great historian on Russia, I mean in Germany. And I'm going to quote something from Gordon Craig now. He said, if some benevolent spirit had granted the peoples of Germany and the neighboring states even a fragmentary glimpse of what lay in store for them in the 1940s, it is impossible to believe that they would not have made every possible sacrifice to maintain the Weimar Republic against its enemies. But that kind of foresight is not given in this world, and the German Republic always lacked friends and supporters when it needed them the most. So we look back to that history and said what we need to avoid in the post-Soviet era is a Weimar Russia, that the new republic, which was being, the new democracy, which was being formed into Russia, did not solve the same fates as the Weimar Republic had in Germany. We went on to say, if this is to be successful, the experience of working with Russia in Bosnia, we talk in the book about our experience of cooperative program in Bosnia, that experience needs to be extended, deepened, and made a permanent part of the security structure of an undivided Europe. And then we want to say, in the rest of this chapter, in this old book, Preventive Defense, we explain why and how. Well, needless to say, the things we explained here, none of them really have happened. The second question we were asked is, what is the greatest accomplishment of this post-Soviet era? And I, to answer that question, I looked to where we had cooperation with Russia, which really worked. And certainly, very high on that list, if not even the highest, is the work which Sig Hecker describes in his book, Doomed to Cooperate, which Amy has already talked to you about. It was, look back on it, it was an almost, certainly you could never have predicted that that was going to work. And even looking back on it, it seems to me amazing that they were able to make it work. You have to believe that a lot of it depended on strong personalities of the people who were pushing it through and making it happen, including, of course, Sig. I think it's worth noting that that cooperation, which seemed very improbable at the time, when it came time for Sig to write the book about the cooperation, that same cooperation was still not available. The environment had changed so much that even the relatively small amount of political support needed for that cooperation was not available. But Sig will have more to tell you, I think, about that. The second area of cooperation was the cooperation of the Russians in dismantling the almost 4,000 nuclear weapons in the three states of the former Soviet Union that inherited nuclear weapons, Ukraine, Kazakhstan, and Belarus. That was a very difficult implementation task. We did it in 3 years. We could not have done it without full cooperation from the Russians and from the Ukrainians. On the last day of that program, when the last nuclear weapon had been taken out of Ukraine, the three defense ministers, United States, Ukraine, and Russia, came together and made a three-way handshake, congratulating ourselves on a job well done, because we all understood that it took the cooperation of all three of us to make that happen. And the third element of cooperation, which I would cite for you, is the Bosnia peace enforcement operation, in which a Russian brigade was embedded in an American division and the Brigadier General Russian commanding that brigade reporting to Major General Bill Nash of the 1st Armored Division of the United States. It was an incredible, and it worked very, in practice, it worked very, very well once we had gotten through the hugely difficult diplomacy to get the agreement to make that happen. And so I want to quote you from one aspect of that on a more recent book that I, in this book, in this chapter on NATO, I described the three different meetings that I had with Minister Gorbachev trying to organize, trying to get an agreement on how we could move forward in Bosnia. The first two ended in complete and total failure. It was that difficult. And the last one, I say, we reached at the last meeting, I finally broke the code. Gorbachev would allow his brigade to report to an American commander, but not a NATO commander. We reached a provisional understanding that General Gorbachev could accept the Russian brigade commander being under the, quote, national command of Russia, unquote, and operational control of General Jowin and tactical command of General Bill Nash. I guess the moral of the story is that words sometimes matter. And in that case, they did. It took 3 months for us to find the right words for doing that later. A few weeks later, Gorbachev and I met at NATO headquarters in Brussels and signed the agreement that formalized the understanding. We conducted the signing beside posters that read, NATO plus Russia equals success. Well, that was a long time ago, but that's what we were looking at then. Now, the third question I was asked, what was the greatest disappointment of that era? And the greatest disappointment is we let this all slip away. We let it all slip away. How did we let that happen? It's a long and a complicated story, but it started with the NATO expansion, in my judgment. And I'm not going to, I have a whole chapter in my book here called The Fall of Security Ties with Russia, in which I go into the more detail on this. But at the beginning of that, the preface of that chapter is a quote from George Kennan, made in 1998. And let me quote you what George said. I think NATO expansion is the beginning of a new Cold War. I think the Russians will gradually react quite adversely, and it will affect their policies. I think, he said, I think it is a tragic mistake. Well, in my chapter, I say it's more complicated than that, but certainly that was the starting point of a downward slide to where we are today. Then the final set of questions that we were asked to address is in today, well, now here's where we are now, what is our greatest challenge? And I'm sorry to say that our greatest challenge is trying to avoid a war with Russia. We've gotten to the point now where that is a real possibility. And I would go one step farther than that and say that if we get into any kind of a military conflict with Russia, even a relatively small military conflict, the danger of it escalating is great. And the Russians, knowing that they are outgunned in conventional forces by the United States and NATO, have made it quite clear that they would move to what they call tactical nuclear weapons. Nobody who has thought about this problem seriously at all believes that once you go to tactical nuclear weapons, there's any way of keeping that from escalating to a general nuclear war. So the greatest challenge we have today, then, is avoiding that first step to a military conflict, because once that starts, nobody knows how to control the escalation. Thank you. I turn it over to you, Mike.
Thank you, Bill. Mike?
We should just stop on that and talk about all that Bill just said. I hesitate to try speaking, but I will, and maybe I'll pick up the story on the lessons learned from my experience in government, talk about the theory of the reset, the results, why it ended, and why the conditions today are different for cooperation, but then tell you my three worries about the new era we're in. So first, the theory of the reset. Are there lessons learned from previous times in U.S.-Russian relations for our current era? And I want to be clear about the way we thought about the reset. And just to remind you, I was at the White House. I was intimately involved in the policy and including coining that term. So if you hate it, it's my fault. If you like it, which are very few people that like it, buy the book and hear the whole story when it's out in the fall. All right. First part of the theory. We never sought out to have better relations with Russia. I think that's one of the most frequently misunderstood things about our policy. Instead, in our policy review that was started in the fall of 2008 and then formalized in the spring of 2009, we defined concrete American economic and security objectives, and then we thought about strategies to achieve them. The other pieces of the theory is that we believed, and the president first and foremost believed, that there were many places that if we engage with Russia, we could accomplish what he loved to call win-win outcomes. The day that the two presidents signed the New START Treaty, by the way, in Prague, fantastic day in terms of U.S.-Russian cooperation, President Medvedev went out of his way to say in English, this is truly a win-win outcome, and then he winked at Barack Obama. Fourth part of the theory was that you had to engage to make it happen, and so that meant at the presidential level, but we created something called the Bilateral Presidential Commission to force our governments to engage in ways that they were not doing before. We also had a business-to-business track, and we also had a civil society track that later got us in trouble. I'll come back to that. Fifth part of our theory. This really was the president's own thinking. It was our theory, it was our hypothesis about the relationship, that previous conflict was not based on history, culture, or the balance of power in the international system. In other words, we had a very agent-centric theory about why there was confrontation before, and that allowed for the possibility of cooperation in the new era. And the last piece of the theory, no linkage. And we got in a lot of trouble for this from our Republican critics and our Russian critics. But we very explicitly said, this was stolen from George Shultz's memoirs, that we were not going to link things that we didn't think were appropriate. So we rejected Russian linkage when they wanted to, for instance, link Georgia to an Iran deal. But we also rejected linkage on our side, for instance, when our critics wanted to link human rights to lifting Jackson-Vanik or bringing Russia into the WTO. That's the theory of the reset in 3 minutes. Okay, not bad. Results. I think the results were fantastic. And I want to remind you, I'll just list them. But I want to remind you, every single of these results that I'm about to talk about happened just 4 years ago. Not 25 years ago, not 100 years ago, 4 years ago. New START Treaty, I already mentioned it. Fantastic achievement. NDN, Northern Distribution Network, a new supply route to our soldiers in Afghanistan. So we went from 5% to 50% through that route, and that had tremendous consequences for our ability to fight in Pakistan, including in one very important day when we went into Pakistan to kill Osama bin Laden. That does not happen without Russian cooperation on NDN. 3, UN Security Council Resolution 1929. The most comprehensive set of sanctions against Iran ever that doesn't happen without Russian cooperation. 4, WTO. 5, increased trade and investment. Got to the highest it had ever been in 2012. It's now been on a decline. 6, new visa regime. And if I had more time, I would go through 22 other ones. In other words, these were real comprehensive cooperation, and not just on the kind of marginal kumbaya kind of issues, let's have peace, love, and understanding and get along. I'm talking about Afghanistan, Iran, nuclear weapons, trade, and investment. And finally, in the cooperative piece, I always like to remind people of the dogs that weren't barking during this period of cooperation. There was no Georgian War. There was no dispute. I don't know if you, do you remember the regime change? This is a good test. At Stanford, so you're going to know. But do you remember where we had a big, there was a regime change in the former Soviet Union during the heyday of this period? Catherine, don't answer. What country am I talking about? You don't know. Well, I'm glad you didn't respond. You do know. Some of you know. I'm talking about Kyrgyzstan, where there was an overthrow of the regime. Dozens of people died. 300,000 people left that country, and it felt like we were on the brink of a genocidal, ethnic-based civil war. It was one of the scariest weeks of my time at the White House. But most of you don't know about it because it never actually got to that point, because President Medvedev and President Obama decided it was in our mutual interest to not let that scenario happen.
think about how different that is from Ukraine 2014. And on missile defense cooperation, we got very close, and most importantly on NATO, because Bill mentioned it. I just want to tell you that I felt, and you don't have to believe me, you should go read President Medvedev, his remarks at the NATO summit in Lisbon, December 2010, where he said we had put this issue behind us, and the substantive piece of that meeting that I was at was about how we can cooperate on missile defense. In other words, whatever the drama was before, we felt like we had managed that in a place because of cooperation, not confrontation. And by the way, in this period, 65% of Americans thought Russia was our partner, and 65% of Russians thought that America was our partner. That's just 4 years ago. You can look up that data. And then we got one more amazing breakthrough. Oh, now my timer went off, so I don't know how much time I have. Keep an eye for me, David, okay?
You've got 4 minutes.
Great. All right, I can finish. Then we had one more amazing breakthrough that was actually the beginning of the end. In the spring of 2011, President Medvedev agreed to abstain and support UN Security Council resolutions 1970 and 73, authorizing the use of force in Libya. We were shocked. I'll tell you, I was on the trip with the vice president when he agreed to it. He would not allow other advisors to be in the room when I just realized we're on the record. Let me be a little more careful here. It was an amazing achievement that then began to nurture discord between Prime Minister Putin and President Medvedev. The first time ever that Prime Minister Putin came out on the record to say that President Medvedev had made a mistake. And that gets me to my third point. Why did the reset end? It ended because protesting people got in the way of our policy. Protesting people in Egypt, in Syria, in Libya, then most profoundly in Russia in December 2011, and then in Ukraine again in the fall of 2013. And it was Putin's view, now as president, that we were behind all of that revolution against his allies, and ultimately against him. And by the way, at times he blamed me personally for that, sitting this close to me. He said, we know what you're doing and we're going to stop you. And for all of our brilliance in our diplomacy, including the president's brilliance, we could not convince them that we were not behind these social movements. And that was the end of the reset. That's where it ended. There were noise about Magnitsky and missile defense, but at the heart of it, that ended it. Optimism for the future. There are two new conditions that were not present during the end of the reset. First, people are not protesting in Russia. Ukraine is not in a revolutionary moment. And Syria, tragically, people are not protesting peacefully there. So all of the issues that were the main source of contention for us are in a different place today as the Trump administration starts. And two, we have a new president, obviously, that has a different view about Russia and has a very different view about the place of democracy and human rights in our foreign policy. That gives me cause for optimism in terms of cooperation. But I have three worries. Two worries? Three? Three? Okay. One, I worry that President-elect Trump has mixed up ends and means. He keeps talking about, wouldn't it be nice if we could just all get along, as if that is the objective of American foreign policy. Well, Putin has a very clear roadmap for how we can just get along. If you want to achieve that objective, you should lift sanctions, you should endorse Russian actions in Syria, recognize Crimea, and recognize Russia's sphere of influence in the former Soviet Union. And if you do all those things, we'll have a fantastic party for you on your first summit when you come to Moscow. He's got to get that right. I don't know what he wants to do. I don't know if it's business development or adoptions, or maybe it's nuclear reductions. I'd be skeptical, but I hope it would be. But we just don't know, and he needs to get that right first. Otherwise, I think it leads to a very bad outcome. Second, in order to get along, we have to not ignore the issue of Russian interference in our elections. I believe that if we do not establish a bipartisan, independent commission to get the facts, this will haunt the Trump presidency for the next 4 years. And third, how will he manage competing goals that he has alluded to? Get along with Russia and tear up the Iran deal are in tension with each other. You can't do those two things together. Fighting terrorism versus allying with Hezbollah and the Islamic Republic of Iran are in tension with each other. supporting our NATO allies versus detente with Moscow might be in tension with each other. It can be managed, as I thought we did during the reset, but it's a tough one. And Russia versus China is in tension with each other. They are cheering in Moscow, and they are upset in Beijing. How does he manage those two relationships going forward? It's a very challenging time for U.S.-Russian relations. Thanks.
Michael, thank you. We were going to get back to a couple of those things after we hear from the next. David.
Right. Thanks very much, David. I'll give a somewhat different perspective, not from government, but from somebody who was working as a historian and going to the Soviet Union while it still existed, and as well as to Russia. And in the late 1980s, it was already clear with Gorbachev's new thinking that major changes were going to come. The Leninist view of international politics as revolving on the axis of the conflict between labor and capital was abandoned by Gorbachev and the group around him. And that opened up the prospect of elimination of the socialist system and an opening up of the international system to the Soviet Union and its successor states and to its former allies. And of course, that had huge consequences, one of them being the overthrow of communist rule in Eastern Europe, most dramatically during 1989. Another area of dramatic progress was what Bill Perry and Sig Hecker were involved in dealing with the nuclear legacy of the Cold War. But I want to point to a more diffuse consequence, and one that I think remains, and that is that, yes, we've had a return to authoritarianism in Russia. Russia is not what people hoped it would become 25 years ago, but still something remains. This is not the Soviet Union. There is an openness to the society. People can travel, people can speak freely, individually, getting access to the media is another issue. Acting collectively to achieve particular goals is another question. But the nature of the conversations you can have with people, especially, say, as a foreigner coming in, it's very different from the Brezhnev years. And that's something that's not trivial, and I think very important for Russian society. There's more access to information. It's not totally free. Some websites are blocked, including newspapers inside Russia itself. But people who want to can get access to information, make up their own minds about things. And it's true that the textbooks have become a very hot issue in terms of the government-backed view of Soviet history. But nevertheless, archives are opening up. There's fantastic research that's been done on the repressions of the 1930s and indeed on Soviet rule overall. So I think one shouldn't forget that. It's a very important aspect of the changes that have taken place. The great failure, to my mind, is the failure to integrate Russia into the international system, or rather to create a new world order or international system into which Russia could be integrated. So relations between Russia and the West, and especially between the U.S. and Russia, have turned out to be far more complex and complicated than one might have expected or anticipated in 1991. And it's gone through different periods. So Mike spoke about the successes of the reset, which were real successes. But then we've had a real downward spiral since then. And it's, I think, a complex history. Domestic Russian politics plays a very important part. The external environment plays an important part as well. You know, there's a saying that any discussion about Russia must address three questions. The first question is, who is to blame? Кто виноват? The second is, what is to be done? And the third is, where is Russia going? And all of these questions refer back to 19th century works of literature. So these are not new questions for Russia. So there is, of course, a debate about who is to blame for the situation we're in now. I don't want to get into that. I think it's a very complicated history. But it does bring us on to the question of what is to be done, where are we going? And here I think we're in really quite a new situation. It's not revisiting the old question from 1991 about how to remold or reshape the international system to accommodate Russia, or how to reshape Russia to make it integrated into the international system. Because I think what we see around us is the liberal order created largely by the US at the end of World War II and sustained by the United States very largely over that period, now in a period of great stress, maybe coming to an end. Russia and China have in recent years been sniping at this from the sidelines, saying their interests and their voices have not been accommodated enough in recent years in the international order. And now we have an administration coming in Washington that also seems, it's not clear, of course, but it seems to reject very important elements of that order, in particular trade deals and military alliances. And that raises the question, what kind of international politics are we going for? It's not just where is Russia going, where are all of us going? And I was in Moscow, I came back about 10 days ago. I had a lot of conversations with people that started from the Russian side. And how about Trump? And the most interesting thing about them, and I would say, well, how about Trump? The Duma cheered when news of his election came through. And everyone said to me, yes, that's true, but people who think soberly about these issues don't share that view. In other words, there's no sense of, oh, now things are going to go right. And in fact, I heard worries expressed that Russia has a president who has used unpredictability as a tactic, and quite effectively in some ways, in foreign policy. And now we have an American president who is unpredictable by tactic, I don't know, or by nature, perhaps. And this is not good, to have two unpredictable leaders facing each other, two unpredictable leaders who have at their command enormous nuclear arsenals. And I think one of the elements of concern and worry that I heard in Moscow across a range of people was precisely this unpredictability. Some people said, oh, we'll have a honeymoon for a little while, and then things will get even worse. But others thought, so nobody was reflecting the image of the Russian reaction that one sees in the American press of saying, oh, great, now we can, you know, improve relations with the United States on our terms. So there is, I did talk to people about nuclear issues. And there is a great concern that the nuclear arms control arrangements of the Cold War, or post-Cold War as well, are essentially falling apart. The INF Treaty, there's no resolution on the issue of ballistic missile defense. There's the whole question of a follow-on to the new START Treaty. There are the dangerous incidents at sea and in the air between Russian forces and NATO forces. And I certainly heard a very clear desire to try to deal with some of those issues as a matter of urgency, to try to make the relationship between our two countries less dangerous, and then possibly moving on to some broader issues. But so I came back very struck that the sense of uncertainty and unpredictability we might have here about policy is shared there as well. This is not a, this, I'm not sure what the implications of this are for the Russian interference in the election, but whoever was interfering was not persuading the people I talked to that, yes, having Trump elected was really a totally good thing for Russia. Thank you.
Good. Thank you. Sig.
Thank you, David. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great pleasure to be here. I can't help but think, what am I doing up here? I like to say I'm just a scientist. And so here I am with distinguished people who've been in the Defense Department and politics and historians. So it actually goes back a little over 50 years, and that is I was a summer student at Los Alamos National Laboratory. And so as I look back at Soviet Union and Russia time, I look back through two lenses. The first 25 years were through Cold War lenses, and that is the Soviet Union. And our job at Los Alamos was to provide the technical capabilities to deter the Soviet Union. And then at the time, or just about the time, the Soviet Union was about to fall apart, I happened to have become director of Los Alamos National Laboratory. And I watched that threat change totally from one where we were concerned about the arsenals, the enormous arsenal of the Soviet Union in the hands of the Soviet government, to now being concerned about the nuclear assets, weapons, materials, people, getting out of the hands of the government. That was the change when the Soviet Union dissolved. Now, it turns out Secretary Perry, of course, wouldn't say this, but in Washington, he was honored on Monday with the Nunn Lugar Medal for the work that he did, not only as Secretary of Defense, but actually even before then at Stanford University with other non-governmental organizations, universities, to help the United States make that transition. And the part that I was able to play in that transition, as Amy had already mentioned, and we've written up in the book, Russian and American Colleagues Together, is the role that the nuclear weapons scientists played to deal with what now were the new dangers. And let me capture, actually, David Hoffman's words in his book, where he talks about those times, and he said, the nuclear weapons, the nuclear complex, they were Russia's inheritance from hell when the Soviet Union fell apart. And I, in the book, I essentially translate that to four nuclear dangers. Loose nukes, that means about, 30, 40,000 nuclear weapons in Soviet Union. Loose nuclear materials, somewhere around 1.4 million kilograms. Let me just put that in perspective. That's plutonium and highly enriched uranium. North Korea today maybe has 20 to 40 kilograms of plutonium. So 1.4 million kilograms. Loose people. That was the hundreds of thousands of Soviet and then Russian scientists, engineers, and professionals. And then loose exports. Would they sell essentially everything that was not nailed down? Those were the concerns. And certainly people like me at Los Alamos were very concerned. How in the world, with the country coming apart, could you possibly avoid a nuclear disaster? And so that's where the scientists began to engage, of course also with the help of the government, but particularly the story that we tell in this book. It was actually the Soviet scientists, still during the end of the Soviet Union, that reached across the political divide first. Some of my colleagues from Los Alamos were invited into the secret cities of the Soviet Union. They got proposals from them wanting to do science together. This was still during Gorbachev time. And then when the Soviet Union fell apart, John Knuckles, who was director of Lawrence Livermore Laboratory at the time, and I went over there in February of 1992. And we visited their secret cities, their facilities, and it was absolutely, totally remarkable. We met them, of course we had to work through interpreters, but we looked at them, we found out what they were doing, and it was like looking in the mirror. They were so fantastic scientifically, and they were motivated patriotically the same way that we were. It was their responsibility to take care of the nuclear deterrent. And so we came back to the United States and we said, look, these guys want to work together. Well, we were far ahead of our times, but we were allowed to do scientific collaboration together, and that's what we did. We started out doing science together. And in fact, the sort of science we did together, some of you who know the nuclear stuff, you've heard the terms megatons to megawatts, and that is taking highly enriched uranium, weapons-grade uranium, from the Soviet Union, then Russia, and converting it to reactor-grade uranium and burn it in our reactor in the United States. It was a great program. It put lots of money into Russia at the time that they needed it. We did something different because the Russians, our nuclear weapons colleagues, didn't think much of that program. There was no science in that program. We did what we called megatons to make a Gauss. Yes, Gauss. Measure of magnetic field. Together, we did experiments that created the highest magnetic fields ever produced on Earth. Through Russian combination, the Russians like to blow things up. So we used the explosive to compress, a magnetic field and reach the highest magnetic fields. That brought out the sort of personal relationship, a working relationship that then, in time, allowed us to tackle those four loose problems. What to do, the safety of their weapons as they were coming back at rates that had never been done before. The security of their materials, including stuff that was left behind in Kazakhstan at the Semipalatinsk test site. We worked together actually over 20 years on that program. Their people themselves, by working with them, we gave them hope. They also got some support to make it through. And so in the end, as we now look back at those years, there were no loose nukes. There were essentially no loose materials. Some problems in the early 90s, but if you look back, 1.4 million kilograms, remarkable. Loose people, what we're concerned about, of the brain drain, not any worse than in this country. Loose exports, some problems in the 90s, but they've become a responsible nuclear exporting state. So somehow, and I don't care where our relationships go from here, but those four loose nuclear dangers were averted through scientific collaboration, support from the government, activities like Secretary Perry's activity of getting the weapons back from Ukraine, Belarus, and Kazakhstan. So those things were important. As we look back now, unfortunately, the nuclear cooperation has been going downhill already for the last 10 years. We recovered a little bit through the reset that one important agreement was actually signed, but it's been going downhill because the intelligence and secret services just didn't want the Americans to have the sort of access we had to their nuclear facilities before, and vice versa. So unfortunately, today that nuclear cooperation is being held hostage by the differences that you heard between Washington and Moscow. So let me just quickly look forward. And as you've heard, the relations are obviously not good today. Moscow and Washington do have very different views as to what the world order should be and their place in that world order. And the sort of weighty issues that Mike McFaul brought up, those are beyond my pay grade. But I can give you some of the things that I've learned by visiting with my colleagues in Russia 52 times in the last 25 years. So here are a few things that I've learned from them. One thing that you find out, they really believe that, look, there is no reason that we should be enemies. You know, the destinies of our countries need not be on a collision course. You know, the world has enough room for both of us. They said, don't demonize the leadership. Of course, today that's somewhat easy to do, but they especially say, don't demonize the people. And I can certainly attest to that. Don't demonize the Russian people. And they said, you know, we love your American values. You can promote those values at home. You can promote them around the world, but don't impose those values. Don't impose those values on others. And they say, at that time, it had particularly meaning suggestion for us, and stay out of the internal affairs of other countries. And what they were meaning, the color revolutions and those things, of course, today, Mike McFaul just put on the table, yes, we'd like them to stay out of our internal affairs. And then they say, even though we can't agree on Crimea, on Ukraine, and my colleagues who I've worked with for 25 years, They just have a different view. You have to understand, Crimea and Ukraine mean something different to the Russians than they mean to us. They say, okay, those problems are just too hard. So let's get on with the simple problems, like nuclear cooperation. Yeah, let's make sure that we don't get the countries back in an arms race. We have to together. We know more than the rest of the world put together in nuclear things and confront the dangers of nuclear terrorism, nuclear proliferation together. And nuclear safety and nuclear security, those jobs are never done. They're never done. We must learn from each other, the lessons learned, best practices. And as the book demonstrates, you know, 30-some articles from both sides, what we've done over those years is what I like to say as we look forward now. We've built up a reservoir of goodwill, a reservoir of goodwill. And we just hope that our governments, perhaps with this window of opportunity that we may have, will come back and draw on that reservoir of goodwill. We're ready to cooperate as soon as the governments let us. Close with the final comment. David, thanks for your patience. From Lev Yabev, who's the first deputy minister of atomic energy for many, many years. He said, our job, the scientists, is to convince our respective leadership that we must continue to work together. The only alternative is suspicion, return to an arms race, increased tension, and he said, we must not go in that direction. We must not go in that direction. Thank you, David.
Thank you all. I would add with about Sig's book, people have been kidding him a little bit about the volumes, the two volumes, but to illustrate some of what we've been talking about today, this book contains very important commentaries and papers from Russian contributors that I dare say, if we had to put it to press today, they would not exist. This is a really important reference book on the whole period of nuclear cooperation, and that's why it's such an important volume. But I'd just like to say, listening to all of you, this framework continues to present itself, which is that when there was not an adversarial relationship, when Russian scientists and when people in Russian democracy wanted to cooperate with us, when, for example, when Medvedev was president of Russia, we had a window there. Mike's talking about a period when Putin was not in the presidency. But we do have a different problem today, is that he's back and he has presented us with a stark list of linkage. And Mike said, you know, you approached this without linkage. What do we do now if Putin is saying, well, sure, I'd be happy to talk to you if you lift sanctions, if you let me off the hook for Ukraine, if. And I guess I'd like to ask all of you, Sig has just made the case that some of these things might be very hard, so should we begin a limited engagement, for example, on nuclear safety and security? Is that worth fencing off and from linkage? Or should we actually say to Mr. Putin, we will hold you accountable for the things that you've done because the West believes they're wrong and we're not going to just give up and start to make deals? So I'd like some of you, all of you, to jump in here and help me understand where do we go tomorrow in an adversarial situation where linkage is being imposed by the circumstances, where the United States has taken a stand, where our values have been articulated as to the Russian people for, we told them, we supported when they got in the streets there holding their signs saying Russia without Putin. What do we do now? I think that this is something that we don't all agree on this panel, and I'd like to tease out a little bit of that.
Can I make an empirical point before we talk about what do we do now? I just want to be clear, because you just mentioned nuclear security. Well, I was in the administration when we started the nuclear security summits, and the first one was a fantastic success in Washington that we co-chaired with President Medvedev. And I just want to be clear that we did not stop that offer. We did exactly what you said, David. It was Putin who didn't show up and decided they're not interested.
And he didn't come to the last.
And he didn't come to the last two, actually, if I remember. And the same on Nunn-Lugar. I was there. I witnessed that. We fought as hard as we could to maintain that. Rose Gottemiller, bless her heart, was leading the charge. Any way, shape, or form, we could keep that available. And I just want to point out, it takes two to tango. So even if you did say, we're going to link it to anything, they themselves made the unilateral decision on those two issues to pull back. So how you get it going again when they're not interested, I think that's a question I posed to my colleagues, that it's not the problem of these other things. It's just even in and of itself, they didn't want to do that. I have other things I want to say later, but I think that's important.
I'd like to ask Sig and Bill Perry about this, because both of you have argued on nuclear security that it's a paramount issue we must engage. And I'd just like you to address what Mike just said.
Bill, do you want to answer?
Say the question again.
Bill, you said on Monday at the we were discussing Nunn-Lugar in Washington that you felt very strongly we should engage with Russia on nuclear security. Can we do that in today's adversarial environment?
We should try. Mike may be right. We may try and not succeed. The approach we should use, I think, drawing on my mathematical background, is when a mathematician is faced with a very tough problem, he looks for what's called separation of variables. We have to find a way of separating the variables and say, here are some problems that we can agree to disagree. We don't know how we're going to solve these. Here's another set of problems. We separate out this other set of problems, which we have a mutual interest in. Let's see if we can make some progress on those, even though we cannot solve these other. I think without that approach, we have no chance of success. Even with that approach, we may not succeed if President Putin doesn't want us to succeed. And I have no way of predicting that.
I actually want to take an issue with what Mike said. With what Mike said is true, that even after all these things happened, the United States still went to Russia and said, look, we're willing to continue to do nuclear security cooperation.
And let me add one more historical point. We also went to them to do a follow-on to the New START Treaty, and they said no.
Oh, well, that one I understand. The other one... is trickier than that. And that is that what happened, nuclear cooperation was already going downhill, looked to possibly be revived, and then Crimea and eastern Ukraine happened. And the word from the White House was that we're not going to do scientific cooperation with Russia. It's not going to be business as usual. However, then what was still held across is, oh, but we're still willing to do security cooperation with you guys. And what the Russians essentially said, look, we want to do cooperation in nuclear energy. We want to do cooperation in science. You don't do science. You do nuclear energy. We're not going to do security. And so there was at least some period of time of maybe a year or 18 months where I thought, from my perspective, the U.S. also impeded the ability for us to continue to actually do nuclear cooperation. I know my colleagues were not allowed to go to the usual Russian conferences that we've gone to because the feeling was somebody's got to teach the Russians that, you know, somebody has to pay.
I don't want to keep talking. Go ahead, David.
I want
to make historical points, but go ahead, David.
No, just to come back to your point, David, so this is not the issue. It's not saying, the Russians are not saying, we'll talk to you about nuclear security if you lift the sanctions and so on. That's not the way the issue was confronted. It's in some ways you can say it's worse. They're just not prepared to talk about these things at all when they should be talked about. And I certainly wouldn't advocate saying, nuclear security is a very important topic. Let's see if we can lure you back by, you know, changing our policy in other areas. It's of mutual importance. And I don't see that the issue, that, as you presented it, actually arose in this particular case in the past. I mean, if I understand what Mike was saying.
Just to jump in. Our attempts to start the follow-on negotiations for the new START Treaty were before the annexation of Crimea, okay? Nunn-Lugar was ended before that. So the period that I was talking about, all of the and when we talk about nuclear cooperation, I think we have to be a little more precise, because I think what Sig is talking about is not the things I'm talking about, right? After that, you're also right that the United States government, the Obama administration, I'd left the government by that time, put on additional sanctions and put additional prohibitions for any kind of cooperation to punish the Russians. That is also true. So both of those are true. My own view is, I just want to underscore what Bill said. We have to try again. In a way, because of the things that these people have participated in their careers and written about, We actually do know the muscle movements for cooperation on nuclear issues. We do have interlocutors in Russia, unlike on some other issues where it's harder to find interlocutors. And maybe in terms of this disaggregation of variables metaphor, which I like a lot, reminds me of things we were writing from Moscow about limited engagement, limited containment. That, I think, is the right approach. I just would caution you that it's not going to be immediate that they're going to want to get involved in these things. I mean, you hinted at it very correctly. For when I was ambassador in Russia, Nun Lugar, which you all celebrated on Monday, I hear, that was called, while I was ambassador, an intelligence operation in Russia. Let's just be explicit about the way that the Russian government, the Security Council in particular, talked about it. So we've got to figure out a different modality, right? Our strategy was to go abroad. That's, if you go back and you look at the documents from the nuclear security summits, especially in the beginning, our strategy was, okay, we've had this fantastic achievement in a bilateral sense, let's try to go abroad, and that then ran into problems in this period I talked about. But I think, the New START treaty will eventually expire. We should have extended it and tried to work with the Russians just to extend it to get more time, but that did not happen. But eventually it's going to come up, and maybe that's, when we start to negotiate on that. And I would just remind you of what one of my colleagues says, once we do, we will then come up against a very difficult problem that we had in the New START treaty, which is about controls on missile defense. We threaded that needle in a very, very delicate way, so delicate that many senators disagreed with us, and we almost didn't ratify it. We only got 72 votes for that treaty. But it was very clear to me, moving forward, we were going to have to link those things. And I want to say, now that it's over, we were ready to think about that. We were ready to think very ambitiously in the Obama administration after re-election, as was picked up very tragically with the microphone in Seoul. But that was his thinking at the time. But if you're not prepared to do that, it's hard for me to see the way forward, and I'm nervous about it.
Well, Michael, I want to just follow up for a second. You've been saying we need to have a commission to investigate this possible Russian interference in our electoral system. You were very outspoken as an ambassador about our values, our universal values. We'll keep speaking out about those values. You championed this idea that this was a great moment for democracy in a place that hadn't had it for 1,000 years or so. So do we now begin to talk about, say, nuclear security and just accept Putin's claim that it's none of our business that he's crushing democracy at home, or that he tried to subvert our democracy? I mean, how do we deal with this adversarial thing? Are you suggesting, and is separating the variables mean just looking the other way?
Well, let me say an analytic point and then a normative point, okay, a policy point. The analytic point I want to make very clear is we were not imposing our values in Russia when I was in the government. I just want to make that clear. I know that's what is stated all the time, but that, if we want to dig into that, were we funding the opposition? That is totally and completely false. I'm here to tell you, I was a U.S. ambassador. I had the highest clearances. John Brennan is my friend. We did not do that. Now, there was a narrative because of these, it turns out that there's these crazy Democrats all over the world. They're in Egypt, they're in Syria, they're in Ukraine, they're in Russia, and they don't take orders from elites like us. We had our reset plan. In our reset plan, it didn't say, and then we're going to foment revolution in Russia in 2011, and then we're going to do it again in Ukraine in 2013. Push to declassify the documents, you'll see it. That was not our plan, but it turns out that there are other people who have different plans, and we don't control them. And that's the analytic point. The other analytic point I would make, when I hear, because it happens all the time when I was in government, let's all agree to not interfere in other people's business. If we could get a regime to do that, that would be great, but I just want to point out for the record, Russia annexed Crimea. Russia intervened in the domestic affairs of Ukraine, in eastern Ukraine. Russia went into Georgia in 2008. Russia launched a cyber attack against Estonia in 2007. Russia just gave $9 million to the National Front in France. Russia has been tweeting in our elections, hashtag crooked Hillary. That's from a Russian government entity, let alone, I didn't even mention the page one news today in the New York Times. So just to be clear, when we hear them say don't interfere, there's a history of interference, and by the way, it goes back well before this current period. There's a long history of that. If we could come up with some rules of the road, I think it would be great, but it has to be looking at the full thing. My last point, analytic point. I don't predict that promoting democracy and human rights is going to be a big part of the Trump agenda. I don't. I mean, I probably more closely than most listens to his words on Russia and these issues over the last 18 months. I don't actually remember the phrase human rights ever coming out of his mouth. And very famously, he said on a television show with Morning Joe, who I guess we now have learned is his new buddy, but back a year ago when they had a little more contentious relationship, on this MSNBC show, he pointed out some of the things you did, David, to then-candidate Trump. And his response to that was, well, we kill a lot of people, too. That's almost a direct quote. You can look it up. Morning Joe in December 2015. So that you can ask me what I think, but I don't think what I think matters anymore. Let's just be clear. I think we will be in an era where that variable, A, for what happened in those countries, I want to be clear about that. There are two of them, right? There are no protests against Putin to speak of right now. Ukraine is in disarray. Syria is a horrible tragedy. So all of the mobilization against these regimes that when I used to be in the room with him, he was extremely animated about in his conversations with the president, they're all in a different place. And now we have a different administration where I just don't see this as being an issue at all. What I don't know is what the issues will be. Like, I'd like just to point out that, like, you know, and maybe that creates an opportunity for people that have ideas for what you could accomplish if indeed the strategy was to just get along. And I think I've used all my time for the rest of the session, so I'll remain quiet. I apologize.
Mike, on behalf of my Russian colleagues, so, you know, I
got I'm, Russian colleagues, too, just so you know.
I know. I think they're cut from a different cloth than some of the ones you dealt with. So what you said, I know what you said is true, because I visited with you in Russia. I know what you were promoting in terms of the United States. However, on the Russian side, the U.S. actions were seen very differently. And I'm not talking about Putin and his colleagues. I'm talking about my colleagues. And so in the book, buried in the 1,000 pages, there's one statement we were talking about to a nuclear weapons engineer who we had worked together with him as to how you take nuclear weapons apart, you know, without them blowing up. And he says, this is so important. Someday, maybe we'll get back again to working together once America stops imposing its will on the world. Okay, so this is a nuclear weapon sign. That's how it's...
So my point is, you're in that era now. That's, you know, yeah. So what should we do? So he doesn't have to worry about that anymore in Russia. I sincerely believe that. USAID was shut down, and all the NGOs were shut down. That drama, if it were, let's just agree to disagree whether we were doing anything or not, and buy my book in September when it's out, where I go through this in very deep detail, right? Just not quite in the detail as your two volumes, but a lot of detail. But let's just set that aside. I don't think that's going to be a drama. So then the question is, well, how should we approach this moving forward? Because I think that's an excuse for a lot of other things, quite frankly. I think that's an excuse for annexing Crimea. Like, I want to be clear about that. For the first time in Europe since World War II, a European country, maybe there's some exceptions, but has annexed territory. And 100 countries agreed with the Obama administration. It wasn't some big dispute in the world whether this was annexation. It was. And the excuse was, well, you're imposing your values, so that gives us a right to annex territory. And I just would point out that now that excuse will be gone, so maybe there's a period for cooperation.
It just seems to me we all here know that what Soviet times were not some kind of holiday. When Bill was secretary, and even before that, working in the middle of the Cold War on those weapons, we all knew we faced an existential threat, an implacable foe, and yet we still managed to negotiate arms control. We actually brought it to a successful close without a world war or a hot war. And yet, hearing all of you and thinking about where we are today, we seem to be kind of at an impasse about how to deal with Putin at a time when he rejects our values and when he's done all these other things you just listed that are difficult, yet we see the need. I don't see a way out, and the Soviet example doesn't seem to offer me one. Does anybody have a brilliant idea?
No. Let me make that clear to start with. There is, interestingly, I think, a difference on the nuclear issue. I've certainly heard it said, and I can't vouch for this, that some of the old guard, still surviving from Soviet days, have been very disturbed about the way in which nuclear weapons have been talked about. Because unless you go back to the Khrushchev years, when Khrushchev made what seemed like rather wild statements about nuclear weapons, Soviet leaders were very careful in what they said about nuclear weapons. It isn't that they didn't build them up or didn't have them, but the dangers of misunderstanding or miscalculation, I think, had been brought home very strongly by the Cuban Missile Crisis. And there is an issue as to whether we now have leaders, and I won't say just Russia, but in other countries too, leaders who don't quite understand what the dangers are. And I think, so we learned a lot about nuclear weapons in the Cold War, but maybe we've unlearned things that we should not have forgotten. And I think that's one of the reasons why the unpredictability is so worrying. If we have two political leaders who pride themselves on being good negotiators, tough negotiators, who, you know, when they get in a fight, you know, double down and don't back away, where does that leave us? So I think that's an element where we could learn from the Soviet experience, but we seem, or the U.S. Soviet experience, I should say, but we seem not to have, and I find that actually rather worrying.
And David, I have to say I'm profoundly pessimistic about our ability to really come to a good negotiation with the Russians for all the reasons that Mike gives. What he said, I think, is exactly right. The only possibility of doing that is if both sides, both the Russian side and the American side, understand that what is at stake here, if we end up in a kind of a nuclear conflict, is the end of civilization. I mean, the stakes are so high, and the issue is not, in my judgment, the issue is not that Russia would plan a nuclear attack against the United States or vice versa. That's what we worried about all during the Cold War, and in retrospect, that was the wrong thing to worry about. The real danger then, and the real danger we're about to go into today, the real danger then would we blunder into a war, as we almost did in the Cuban Missile Crisis, whether we'd have an accidental nuclear war, like we almost happened to us several times in the U.S. and a couple times in Russia as well. So the danger of a new Cold War starting up, which is what I think is about to happen now, the danger is that we'll recreate the conditions of the Cold War, in which the possibility of an accidental nuclear war or nuclear war by miscalculation are now prevalent again. That is the danger, and that is such a great danger. The stakes are so high that we must find a way of dealing with this problem. I don't see any way at all of resolving the problems that Mike is talking about. They're very real and they're very important problems. But on the scale of that and the nuclear holocaust, they're quite different.
Good. Well, we could keep going on. We obviously care a lot up here on the panel about this, but I'd like to have questions from the audience before we finish up. So I think we have microphones that we'll bring around to people, and I will call on you. I'll try and get as many as we can. Let's start right here in the center, and I'll try and catch everybody's got a hand up in the time we've got. Wait for your mic. Here.
I wonder if any of the panel have an opinion about the designation of Tillerson as Secretary of State.
I think the panel wants to wait till he's confirmed.
Actually, follow me on Twitter. I said several things about him there. At McFall. But go ahead. Do other people want to say anything?
All right. Let's move on then.
Well, no, that's not. That's a fair question. I think it's very related. I mean, I don't know him personally, but I know the ExxonMobil people very well. And I want to be optimistic that there is an opportunity in cooperating. I mean, David, I don't want to, David's friends, the things you were reporting for Moscow, I haven't been to Moscow for a while because I myself am a victim of this period we're in. When Mr. Sechin was put on the sanctions list, I was put on in response. And Mr. Sechin is Mr. Tillerson's business partner in Moscow, and they lost a lot of money as a result of that. I don't support his nomination as a Secretary of State yet. I it's not personal. It's just I don't think that somebody who spent four decades running an oil company should run the State Department. I think he doesn't have the right background for that, and the kinds of negotiations one does in that job give you a limited perspective. And there are lots of other things in his portfolio, including everything we just talked about. He's never talked about. He doesn't know what a throw weight was. He doesn't know what telemetry is. He doesn't know what an SM3 is. That's my prediction. And I want to keep my mind open for the potential that he'll learn about those things, or maybe he does know, and as the confirmation hearings goes through, I reserve the right to change my mind. Not that anybody's asking me what my... Actually, people are asking me, but... and that's what with him. But on the upside, I do want to make this point that I made in my opening remarks. There is... Maybe it'll be a short honeymoon period, as I think David alluded to, but there will be a period, and this person knows Vladimir Putin better than any other non-government official in the United States, with the possible exception of our colleague Henry Kissinger and Steven Seagal. Those are the three. I'm not joking. This was our job at the embassy to know who could have access to him, and he does. And so with the right agenda in front of him, you know, maybe this is an opportunity to leverage that in a positive way, again, in the very constrained parameters that we were just talking about.
Thank you. Sig has a comment.
That nomination doesn't scare me as much as some of the rest of the discussion as to who might wind up in the Department of State, because he is an unknown. However, some of the people that have been mentioned as far as Department of State, they know the international arena, and they have views that are potentially absolutely disastrous. And we're talking here about Russia, but we have to keep in mind there's North Korea. North Korea is an incredible problem right now, not when it reaches the United States. It's a problem today. We have Iran, where a deal was made to sort of tune things back. If we now get people who know something about international issues, and they have views that we've heard, you know, maybe some 10 years ago, then we're in for a very rough ride in areas like North Korea and Iran.
Okay, let's get some more questions. I'll come over here. We got a mic for you. Stand by.
Yeah, Don Emerson, Stanford. I'd like to ask a very specific question. I'd like to ask a very specific question. It seems clear that the Russians, whether it's the GRU, the FSB, Cozy Bear, the evidence seems overwhelming that Russia did, in fact, intervene in the American electoral process, okay? To what effect, we can debate. But that's not my question. My question is, what should the American response be? Should we all wait until what could be a prolonged series of investigations, whether by a special panel, by Congress, and so forth, putting it off perhaps until February of next year, or even farther? Should Obama do something before he leaves office? And if that seems inappropriate, what should the Trump administration do, perhaps by the end of January? And I want to say also, could you distinguish between a private response, which Russia would know, but the rest of us would not, versus a public response, and also how kinetic it might be?
So you're going to see all of American policy made up here on the stage. And then, Mike, you want to start?
I've spoken a lot. I'll go ahead David. If nobody else wants to. But.
David.
No, I love Mike.
Bill.
Go ahead.
All right, I think I'll take this one on because, but I think, first of all, the facts that we've seen so far do suggest that they made this intervention. But one thing I would be cautious about are claims that anybody has gotten inside Putin's head. And some of the claims are that it was very specifically known what his intentions were. I think it's pretty clear that his intentions were to disrupt Hillary Clinton's campaign. I'm not so sure that he was intending to pick what he got, another unpredictable partner. We have all here written histories about how difficult it was for the United States with its spectacular intelligence gathering operation to figure out the intentions of the Soviet leaders over decades. I don't think we've suddenly cracked that code. So one thing to be careful of is to jump to conclusions about intentions. But as to the actual facts of it, the digital trail of crumbs is growing more and more evident, and I think they need to be investigated and exposed. This is the kind of thing that I think we should be outraged by as we see it. But those who have been studying the problem of cyber conflict in the past 4 or 5 years as it grew more intense will tell you, in this kind of conflict, which has now become just as much an area of international conflict as land, sea, air, and outer space. This is a domain of conflict. There are certain very, very immutable characteristics, one of which is attribution. In other words, who done it is extremely hard. Secondly, cyber conflict happens at network speed, instantly, and it's a lot harder months later to figure out what happened. In other words, the response is oftentimes so much later. And thirdly, escalation, in other words, the kind of thing that we worried about in the Cold War with nuclear weapons, is a serious possibility. And do you want to do something that will essentially lead to further escalation? What if we strike through an invisible cyber retaliatory strike, and then they strike and shut down a hospital in the middle of the night, the power goes out, and people's lives are in danger? How do you cope with this new cyber conflict? That's really what all this, besides the impact on our democracy, we're seeing the first raw signs of a new domain of international warfare and conflict right here.
Can I add one thing, David? Or go ahead.
Just tongue-in-cheek. My advice to President Trump when he is in is don't nuke him.
I'd like to make one comment about that dealt with the question of attribution, which I don't really know for sure what has happened. There's something went on for sure, but who did it and for what motive, I don't think I understand from anything that I've read. And I want to just give you one historical reference. Now, when I was the Secretary of Defense, we had an incident in Saudi Arabia where a terror group blew up an American Air Force barracks, killed about 20 airmen. And we were all set for retribution. The question was, to whom? The Saudi government believed, and most of our intelligence people believed, this was done under the order and the direction of the Iranian government. And as Secretary of Defense, I was directed to prepare an airstrike against Iran. And we had it all prepared. While this research, the intelligence was going on as to who done it. After about 3 months, with this plan sitting on the getting staler and staler, we finally concluded we didn't know for sure who did it. And in retrospect, I think the person who probably behind it, wasn't even on our suspect list. It was a man named, not well known then, named Osama bin Laden. I suspect that he was the one who was actually behind it, and the Iranian government had nothing to do with it. But we were all set to bomb cities in Iran in retribution for what we thought they had done to us. So the attribution question is very, very important. And when we're talking about any kind of strong action, military action, you better be damn sure you're right on the attribution.
Could I just add a footnote to that? First of all, if you're interested in this question, Amy Ziegart, sitting right here, runs our cybersecurity project. We've just been interacting on a memo that goes through the easy to the very hard all the way through. We'll send it to you. But maybe, Amy, you should organize a meeting to follow up, and I'll bet you we'll get all these people to come back after the new year to talk, because your answer, we can't squeeze a smart answer in the 30 seconds we have. But to Bill's point, about attribution, if you've seen me on TV or read me or follow me, you know for the last several weeks, all I talk about is the necessity for a bipartisan, independent commission to negotiate, to investigate this. It cannot be the Obama administration by themselves. They can't investigate themselves. I think they made some big mistakes, for instance. I would like to know more. It cannot be hearings for a few days because that will be a partisan circus. I think this is serious enough that it should be like we had after 9-1-1 so that we get the facts before we go off doing these things. And if you want to be active and not just be upset, you can put your support behind a bill. It's called the Protecting Our Democracy Act. To establish a national commission on foreign interference in the 2016 election. It's Congressman Swalwell and Cummings who have put it forth. Look it up, call your congresspeople, and be active in it. Because without this, then we'll never know the facts. There's more news breaking tonight in terms of intelligence. There's been some stuff leaked. Watch NBC News tonight, not to. NBC Nightly News tonight, we'll be talking about it there. But I don't believe we'll ever get to the bottom of it unless people like these scientists are involved in it and are dig down in it, not just in the way that we've been handling it so far.
Okay, let's try and take one more question. There's a big hand up in the back there. I'll take that one. We are out of time, but go ahead,
so,
quick.
So where do you see the strategic triangle of Russia, U.S., and Chinese relations? We've spoken that Russia might be hopeful about a Trump presidency, whereas China is not. Do we see Russian and Chinese convergence continuing at the same rate that it has in the past few years?
One way to think about statements that have been coming out of the Trump administration is to see a courting of Russia and a bashing of China. And you could imagine in some realpolitik sense that maybe there is a strategy there that to try to establish better relations with Russia and to wean, as it were, Russia away from China. And you could imagine that has a certain kind of crude plausibility to it. But I think that Russia and China, I mean, if that's what's going on, it seems rather transparent. And you would wonder what the incentive would be for Russia, as it were, to loosen or weaken its relations with China in order to achieve better relations with the United States. Surely, if there's any bargaining to be done, and if that were the goal of U.S. policy, I'm not saying it is, by the way, then why shouldn't Russia keep its good relations with China and at least maybe use that as a potential bargaining chip? I think it's very unclear what's going to happen because I think we don't know what's going to happen in Europe. Statements coming out of the administration throw doubt on the U.S. alliance with Japan and South Korea, on NATO, the commitment to NATO. What this will all set in motion in terms of relations among the great powers is very unclear. We have a lot of commentary suggesting we're leaving the post-war liberal international order and going back to great power politics. But I don't know if we can go back to great power politics of the kind that we've known in the past. So I think everyone is beset by certain elements of uncertainty and unpredictability. And my guess is that in that context, there'll be some incentive to try to hold on as far as possible to existing good relations rather than jettisoning them in the interests of pursuing some other grander goal.
I think it's instructive to look at a historical example of China bashing. The last example I can think of is when Bill Clinton was running against George H.W. Bush. And Clinton had a really profound China bashing as part of his campaign strategy, much more so than Trump has done. And the first year of the Clinton presidency, nobody was allowed to go to China. He carried it forward for 1 year. The second year, I was allowed to go as the Secretary of Defense. The third year, Clinton himself went. Clinton ended up having the warmest relation with China of any president in our history, really. But he started off, just want to remind you, it started off as profound bashing of China when he was running as a candidate. So let's not be too quick to predict what President-elect Trump is going to do when he becomes president.
Well, I want to thank our panelists. As you can tell, the world is a big work in progress. We didn't resolve anything, but thank you.
Thanks for listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. Follow us on Twitter at FSI Stanford or visit our website at fsi.stanford.edu for more events and expertise from the world of international studies.